accession number 18771, reel 3.
This is Watts, reel 3.
My mother and I were walking past this nursery, and there was one of the girls that had been our leaders in the Land Army, and because she had been a party member and a very active Nazi, she was not allowed to do anything other than manual work on the land, apart from which there wasn't any work in those days because the Russians had just moved in. And I remember our eyes met, and I remember she went deathly pale. And my mother and I just said, "Hello, times have changed, haven't they?" And she just nodded, the girl just nodded, and my mother and I went our way. Why she became so pale is of course obvious, because in those days a lot of people were denounced to the Russians as ex-Nazis. But that's something we wouldn't have done, my mother and I.
What did the Russians do with people who were denounced to them as ex-National Socialists?
Whether they were summarily shot, I don't know, but certainly a lot of people disappeared.
Now, coming back to the war and mm-hmm. your period of Land Army service, you said it was 6 months in Niederlausitz?
6 months, and then we should have gone 6 months into a munitions factory, but I was invalided out because I and some other of my friends had caught jaundice, and we were deemed unfit for further service because we weren't very well. And my father managed, and of course I'd missed the beginning of the university term. I think I was demobbed from the Land Army in October. I think it was a bit late. And I then worked in the Institute for Tropical Hygiene in the university grounds, where they raised bred tsetse flies in mice or something like that, and did research into sleeping sickness. And I was trained to do slides. The poor mice were killed eventually, and all their blood was drawn off and put on the slides, and then had to be colored, you know, stained through various stains. And I also did, and some samples were put in wax, and then they were put through a very fine machine, it was called a microtome, into very, very fine slices, and that sort of work for 6 months. And then I started at the university.
So you were like a laboratory worker?
Laboratory worker, yeah.
Do you know which year this was?
That was the winter, autumn 44 to 45, yes.
Autumn 1944?
44 to 45. It was 44 to 45. I beg your pardon, I've made a mistake here. 44 to 40. I went to 43. I did my exam. 44. I'm completely confused now. No. 43 to 44. Must have been, yeah. Because
you're 18, 19.
Yeah, I was going on 19 then. Yeah. Winter 43 to 44, that's what it was.
And this was the campus of Berlin University?
Yes, which later became the Russian sector. But I wasn't there very long. I only did one, what we called semester. And then the summer halls started, and in the summer halls we were drafted into the factories for war work. We were supposed, we were meant to go back and go on studying, but we never went back because we weren't allowed back. We had to stay in the factory. So that was summer of 44.
What kind of war work did you do?
I worked in the kitchens. I peeled potatoes and, well, mainly peeled potatoes and chopped cabbage and various things like that. It was a very, very big munitions factory. No, they didn't make munitions. They made ambulances.
This is in Berlin?
Outskirts of Berlin.
What was the name of the place?
Oberschöne Weide. And the factory name was Ambi Bud. AMBI hyphen BUDD.
What was it like working in the kitchens of that factory?
You may well ask. It was in the cellars. It was very, very big. It had a very, very big cauldron-type boilers with gas underneath in which potatoes were boiled and all sorts of soups were stirred, with taps to run off water, a stone floor. We wore no stockings, we wore clogs and waded through the hot water when they drained the potatoes off, sitting on little wooden stools. The ceilings were very low and some sort of piping ran right along. And on that piping, I don't know whether it was hot water or whatever, and on the piping, all the time, morning, noon and night, no matter what you did, the rats were running along, to and fro. And they had a large contingent of displaced persons working for them. Belgium, Dutch, Russian, Ukrainian, a large proportion. And they were just in the factory, and they were in a different camp. Czechoslovakians. They were in a different camp, of course, and they just, you know, worked there, and that was it.
How did you get on with the displaced persons?
You didn't have that much to do with them. There weren't any in the kitchen. You couldn't talk much to them because none of them spoke German or would speak German. Right? I just remember later on, I worked in the office. I was taken out of the kitchen and I did very easy office work. And we had a little Ukrainian woman who was heavily pregnant. And she just did the cleaning of the office. She dusted and, you know, just very light work. And by that time, it was 44 to 45, food was so scarce, it was just, well, it was scarce. And I remember I once gave her an apple, and she immediately ran out to the next office where there was another one working. She wasn't pregnant, but she was dusting. And she ate half of the apple and gave the other half to the other Ukrainian girl, who, by the way, often were very, very beautiful, naturally beautiful. Yeah?
Did she thank you for the apple?
Oh, yes, she did. I mean, she just said, danke, danke. That was, you know, she could say that. And she later on had a little boy. Heavens, you know, under those circumstances. Dreadful.
But you still hadn't started university.
That was after the university. If we recall, it got a bit confusing. I started the university. I am confused now. Hold on a minute. 43 I finished. 43 I went to the... Yes, 44 I went to the... In spring 44 I went to the university. Did my one semester with the summer breakup halls of the university. I was drafted into the factory where I stayed till almost the... the war's end. I only had a couple of months at the university.
What were you studying in the semester?
Medicine. Just the beginning. Just the start.
What were your hopes? What were your ambitions as far as the job was concerned?
At that time, I was engaged to a young fellow, 6 years my senior, who was a doctor. Rather, he was just in the last semester. And we were hoping to work together somehow. Except it didn't happen because he was killed during an air raid when I was 19, in September 44. So that was the end of that.
Were you present when he was killed?
No. He was killed in what was then called Carlsbad. If you remember, a lot of the Eastern Territories were under German, shall we say, rule? And he was writing, he was getting material together for his thesis, for his doctorate. And he was in a certain place. It was very far away from Berlin. He was in a certain place. And there was an air raid warning. I heard this afterwards from his parents, who went down to get the urn back. There was an air raid warning. He was upstairs in this certain place, writing away. And the caretaker apparently came up and said, "Would you please come down into the cellar?" And apparently he said, "Oh, for heaven's sake, they're just flying over towards Vienna or whatever, as they always do." But they didn't. That one time, this little town, Carlsbad, wasn't very important or anything, whatever. That one time, they bombed it, and that building got direct hit, and he was killed.
So is this place now in the Czech Republic?
That's right. Carlsbad, Karlovy, something or other.
Karlovy Vary.
Yeah, Karlovy Vary, they call it.
Can you remember when the air raids started, when you first started to experience them?
It started fairly early. I seem to remember war having been declared. And the next minute, like 3 days later or 2 days later, the sirens went. Because I think in the beginning, they said, the authorities said, as soon as a plane comes near, an enemy plane comes near the German border, the alarm will go off. So, of course, there was a lot of nothing happening. There was an awful lot of nothing happening at first. Oh, yes, I remember this. When the war had been declared, about a fortnight later, we lived near a biggish square, a residential square with flowers and that, but buildings all round, and some of the buildings had flat roofs. And I remember anti-aircraft guns being placed on the roof. And that was part of the phony war. The soldiers used to stand with their binoculars and waved to us, and we waved back. You know, that was the beginning of the war, but that soon stopped. And the first air raids were basically the siren going and then nothing but anti-aircraft fire. no evidence of planes or anything. Later on, when the war proper, the air raids proper had started, sometimes we went upstairs to check for incendiaries. Not very often, because we didn't. We stayed in the cellars. But then sometimes we saw the planes caught in the
searchlights.
And in those days, of course, you'll have to forgive me, but that was the enemy, and one used to think, oh, get them. Except for one time, after an air raid, I think one of the bombers exploded quite near where we lived. And I must have been 15. Yes, 15. Yeah. Not older than 15. And when I went to school the next morning, there were all sorts of bits and pieces hanging. We lived in a tree-lined street. All sorts of bits and pieces hanging from the trees. Getting a bit tough. This terrible experience of seeing bits and pieces hanging from the trees and then looking and realizing it was half a face with goggles, I think, and a bit of an arm and clothing hanging down, and this terrible realization that here was a human being like us, somebody's son or somebody's husband, brother, whatever. And that changed my feelings completely. And I felt, I don't know, also, why should all this happen?
It changed your attitude towards the enemy. Did any bombs fall very close to where you were sheltering ever?
Yes. We used to call it landmines, or rather air mines, Luftminen. We didn't get a direct hit. It was a couple of roads further on, but the impact was such that you were sort of lifted off your chair where you were sitting and went down again, and everything shook. And when we went upstairs, we happened to live on the third floor. When we went upstairs, all the windows had caved in, or most of them, of our flat. Some of the walls, the dividing walls, had collapsed, and the front door was sort of wedged in between somewhere, and all the tiles from the roof had come off. 2 days or 3 days later, we received a load of roof tiles, and we all formed, how many people were we in our little house? 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, something like that. We formed a long chain and started passing these tiles, these roof tiles, quite large, quite heavy, passing the roof tiles from hand to hand up the stairs. And one oldish fellow was standing, and he was packing them down, quite a large area. And it was quite hard work. They were rough. We wore gloves, whatever we had, wore gloves. But within an hour, they had been rubbed through, you know. And you got another pair of gloves and so on. We covered the roof and It happened once more. We covered it again. We got another load of tiles. And the third time it happened, we didn't get anything to cover it. So from then on, the rain came through and all the rest of it. That was the time when the bombing had started, seriously, earnestly. We didn't get fire engines at all. In the beginning, official buildings, yes, ministries and things like that. But when it really started, the town just burnt, and that was it. There wasn't much you could do at all. 99%, I think, was destroyed. 99 point something percent of Berlin was destroyed.
Were the air raids solely at night, or did you get day raids as well?
We had some day raids, but I cannot remember all that much about them. I think they were mainly at night. Yes, mainly at night.
How frightening was it for you?
I was very frightened. I think everybody was frightened. I was very frightened. But you were led into this gradually. If you had realized how frightened you were going to be, you would have thought, I can't do this. That I cannot cope with. But it started gradually, and it increased and increased and escalated, and you took it every day that little bit more, that little bit more. And there you were.
Do you think that the bombing increased or decreased the resolve of Berliners to continue with the war?
I think everybody was terribly weary and wanted it to end. But you had to see that you couldn't do anything about it. You wanted to escape it, but you couldn't. And I don't think, I don't know, somehow perhaps, it sounds funny this, but somehow perhaps it even became almost a way of life, as if this was it for forever and ever. And then, of course, on the other hand, towards the end, we knew that from the east the Russians were nearing Berlin. Yeah? And that was something else to worry about. I remember my father had died. My father died in February 45, just before the Russians moved into Berlin. My mother, of course, was completely destroyed by it all, by his death, and as was I, but youth is more resilient somehow. And also I was worried about her, so I sort of swallowed it and thought, you know, let's get on with this sort of thing. Near where we lived, there was a sort of park and a hill, and they had built what was called in those days a bunker, a warren of shelters right into the hill, reinforced with wood and what have you. And my mother could not stand hearing the falling of the bombs anymore. So we went down into this shelter, and you couldn't hear a thing. And by the way, as a sideline, that shelter, we realized, was built by concentration camp inmates. because some were along the line in the darker corners. There was light in there. In the darker corners, they had scratched "one cigarette, please," or "one slice of bread, please." We heard that it had been built by concentration inmates. What? And, you know, these people had built it, and they were probably trying to, I don't know, get people to leave some food behind, or I don't know, right? And I remember we went into this warren of whatever, you know, very rough shelter, just benches along. And at one point, when I came out, I thought, I can't understand this. Every time we come out of this bunker, there's thunder. There's a thunderstorm brewing. A thunderstorm brewing. Until I realized it wasn't a thunderstorm at all. It was the gunfire from the Eastern Front. And it came, every time we came out of this wretched thing, night after night, it came nearer and nearer and nearer. And I had a premonition, and I said to my mother, "I'm sorry, Mum, I am not going into that bunker anymore. I just didn't want to." So she very, very reluctantly agreed. And apparently, when the Russians moved in, the carnage in there was indescribable because people couldn't escape. There were just two exits. And then all this rabbit warren of side tunnels here and tunnels there to sit in. And apparently that it was absolutely unbelievable, the things that happened in that bunker.
You mean when Russian infantry went in?
Sorry?
When Russian infantry went in?
Mm-hmm. Yes. We had it coming to us, of course. Let's be honest. I mean, we, population, normal people, are usually innocent. But, as we say in Germany, mitgefangen, mitgehangen. If you're caught, you're hung too. You're strung up too. Do you get the meaning?
Even the innocent.
Even the innocent, right? Because there were many innocent people, let's face it. Many innocent people. So, as it happened, when the Russians came into our cellar, we were the first instance. We were incredibly fortunate compared to what happened to other people. Again, it was a very, very frightening moment. We were sitting in the cellar, and the entrance was over the cellar ceiling. And you could hear them coming along and down the stairs. And then they threw open the door, and the first thing we saw was a bayonet like that. And I thought, right, that's it.